Hello, and welcome to The Politics Show here on B Radio. My name's Archie Monk, and today I'm delighted to be joined by two fellow students at the University of Reading, Dom East and Sahila Rasir. On this week's instalment of The Politics Show, we're going to be talking about the world in 2032, more specifically, the aftermath of COVID and its effects on the workplace, the state of the climate and international environmental politics, as well as the cost of living and poverty as we move into the future. To start off, here's your news roundup for the week. Here are this week's headlines.
Russia has invaded Ukraine, in which NATO says it's a cold-blooded, pre-planned invasion. Missiles have hit multiple key points in Ukraine, including an airport in the western region of the country. Kiev is bracing for an invasion as Russian forces surround the Ukrainian capital. Sanctions against the country will come from the West, with the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson saying in a news conference that the UK cannot and will not look away at Russia's hideous and barbaric attack on Ukraine. Vladimir Putin also held a similar news conference, in which he said in a controlled manner, "Whoever tries to stand in our way or create threats for our country and our people should know that Russia's response will be immediate and lead you to consequences you have never encountered in your history."
The government has announced their living with COVID plan, which means that all restrictions will come to an end as of yesterday, meaning it's no longer a legal requirement to self-isolate when you test positive. Along with this, the government also announced from the 1st of April, COVID tests will no longer be free for most people unless they are over 85 or at severe risk of the virus. The pharmacy Boots has already come under fire from the public after they announced they will sell a single LFT test for £5.99, with the GMB union describing this move as rampant profiteering. The company has come out and since announced they will drop down the prices, being £9.50 online for a pack of four, yet it seems to still be profiting off a serious illness.
The Queen has postponed two more virtual engagements this week. The 95-year-old head of state is still battling COVID after testing positive on Sunday last week. Luckily, though, the Queen will continue with light duties, as her symptoms seem to be mild and cold-like. Onwards and upwards, ma'am.
Dolce & Gabbana announced just over a week ago that they were going to cease killing animals to use for fur in their products and will transition to eco-friendly fake fur options. This comes after other fashion brands like Canada Goose announced similar objectives. The Humane Society International saying their decision was a monumental step in the demise of cruel fur fashion.
The supermarket chain Tesco has announced that it has removed more than 1.5 billion pieces of plastic from its UK business since it launched its eco-friendly 4R strategy: remove, reduce, reuse, recycle. This includes more than 200 million plastic bags from their online deliveries, 42 million plastic forks, spoons and knives from prepared salads and rice bowls, and 14 trays for whole chickens. Sarah Bradbury, the quality director for the company, said in a recent press release regarding the achievement that we all have a responsibility to take care of our planet, and removing unnecessary plastic is an important way that Tesco can reduce its environmental impact.
Wales has announced a basic income experiment, with the government targeting vulnerable young adults. Under the scheme, every 18-year-old leaving care within a 12-month period will be paid £1,600 a month, regardless of their employment status. There have been critics of this, questioning the large amounts of money being given out. But Malcolm Torrey, general manager of the Basic Income Earth Network, argued back by saying these experiments have worked in Finland and India and that they have actually increased employment activity.
In local news, Reading Football Club have back-to-back wins, following on with the appointment of interim manager Paul Ince. Lucas Joao and John Swift scored the crucial goals for the club, who are currently battling just above the relegation zone after a six-point deduction earlier on in the year. Derby County Football Club are trying to make a late-season charge out the relegation zone, making it harder for Reading FC to stay in the Championship.
And finally, it's election week here at the University of Reading. The four full-term officer roles are up for election, with today, Friday the 25th, being the last day to vote. This isn't just a chance for you to vote for cheaper snake bites or more summer parties, but a chance for you to make a change within the university. We all hope you voted, as we all have.
And that's the end of this week's news. An instalment of the University of Reading Politics Show would surely be incomplete without some more words on our very own RUSU elections. A frontrunner is Sheldon Allen, who is promising a RUSU big summer blowout of events at the Student Union, on the back of the success of Mojo's on the Meadow last year. He's also tapped into something that I'm sure all students at Reading have experienced, and that's some of the seriously expensive and sometimes very poorly managed student housing. To find housing in the student area, which doesn't look like a hippie's squatting arrangement, students need to cough up a minimum £400 a month each, with some houses costing £500, £550, or even £600 a month per student. The standard maintenance loan is roughly £4,300 per year, so roughly £1,400 per term. So if you don't get help from family or have a part-time job, worries about paying rent can be extremely stressful for some students. Sonal Zahid, a first-year finance student and 10-year resident of Reading, in his manifesto based around communications, pledged to make sure that every voice in the university is heard. His campaign is all about increasing the opportunities for students, whether that's trips, societies, or other events.
Charlotte Hemsley has pledged to increase accessibility to RUSU services and the reintroduction and extension of anti-spiking measures following a number of spikings in the nightclubs in central Reading as well as the 360 student nightclub. It's also Hemsley's aim to recognise and mitigate the environmental impact of a campus of over 20,000 students. Fellow student of our module, The Media and Politics, Tariq Ahmed has a jam-packed agenda filled with his character-like enthusiasm. One of his main manifesto pledges is to prioritise men's mental health. Tariq says, and I quote, "Men's mental health is being ignored because they are labelled as privileged, but depression and anxiety does not care about gender." Tariq has also pledged to keep the RUSU events bus going, something that has been a great help to all students, mainly because it's a much safer way of getting home after a night out, but also because it saves you from having to stumble home in the early hours of a Thursday morning. Layla Cole, whose campaign slogan is "More coffee, more pads, less debt," proposes a loyalty card scheme in the library cafe and at Dolce Vita. Speaking from personal experience, this would be a very welcome reform of the current campus food situation, which at times seems extortionate and not worth it. Layla Cole has also committed to implementing sanitary products in all toilets and student support areas, a reform which I'm sure will be welcomed by everyone requiring these products.
A campaign that has caught the attention of a number of people, it must be said, most likely the boys of this university, is the campaign of Edward Gregory, who has pledged to lobby Park Bar to reduce the price of a snake bite down from £2.45 to the original £2.20. He has also pledged to, and I quote, "organise more interesting and entertaining events, culminating in the loosest night in Reading." But Gregory's election-winning manifesto has been challenged with a serious take on the RUSU presidency from Casey Byron, who has promised that strong leadership can ensure that the full potential of RUSU can be realised. Casey has promised to make himself more accessible to all students, and that all student voices will be heard and considered when making decisions about the future of the student union.
So there they are, the candidates for the RUSU election of 2022. It is great to see some of the political spirit amongst the students at Reading, and there have been close to 10,000 votes in this year's election campaign. I would say to all of those who haven't voted to vote. Voting for the RUSU presidency may be even more important than voting in your local elections. Because the RUSU elections are only voted on by students, our voice counts for more than in normal elections, as we are voting out of a relatively small pool, as opposed to a whole constituency or community. As well as this decision taken by the leaders of RUSU, such as events, safety protocols and student access to resources, are more likely to directly impact our immediate life as students than some diluted Westminster policy on market regulation or the legal system that the MP you voted for may have implemented. Luckily for us, living in a democracy both at the university and in the UK as a whole, we have a voice for change and we should use it.
We were extremely lucky to be able to talk to Jess Phillips. Jess Phillips is a high-profile Labour MP who has run for leadership of the Labour Party and gave us a really valuable insight on key issues in British politics. Our fellow broadcaster, Dom, spoke to the MP and started by asking her whether she thinks the cost of living will continue to rise over the next 10 years.
Yeah, look, it's quite impossible to say, like most economists are essentially making up predictions. But I can see no sign of it abating at the moment, the cost of living. Now, there are shocks that are occurring currently because of external factors, be that Brexit, you know, and it's all happening at once. And so maybe this current spike is exactly that, a spike. And that, whether that's, you know, geopolitics that's leading to gas and to energy price rises across the board, the cost of raw energy, the effects of Brexit on our economy, and obviously the recovery from the pandemic, the sort of contraction and restriction that has happened in that period. The thing I know is even if it doesn't spike and continue at the same pace, prices don't go down again. Like, you know, when they're high, energy prices can fluctuate. It's very uncommon that prices will drop again to pre-pandemic levels. And so fundamentally, the effect on my constituents will only not be abated if wages and welfare, and that includes pensions, rise at that same level. And that's simply not happening. So that it's actually not the prices that is the issue. It is the gap between the prices and the wages that is problematic.
Perfect. So my second question is, with the rise of like social media feeding us constant information and people allowing to express their own opinions, whether it's right or wrong, and the right-wing media becoming more commonplace, how do you think the political landscape of Britain and possibly the rest of the world will be in 10 years' time as well?
I mean, I can't feel like it's going to get any worse. I feel like it's really reached a peak of total horror. I had to ring the police twice today. So, yeah, it's not great. What do I think it'll look like in 10 years? Fascism is cyclical. We are foolish enough in our country to... Not in our country, sorry. We are foolish enough as a generation of people. And most people alive today have in the UK and the US, have lived through a period of the last 70 years of liberal democracy. And we're foolish enough to believe that that's the default. But actually, liberal democracy, since the beginning of human civilization, has existed for about 80 years. And yet, out of all of that time, we thought that that was the default, this tiny bit. I have watched the rise of the right come round twice now in my lifetime. And social media certainly has, in the second time I've watched sort of hard right fundamentals, really inform public policy. Social media has made it seem much more pernicious in everyday people's lives and much easier to spread like fire. So there's no doubt that has caused a problem. However, I think that these things tend to be in trends, but only if we work to get rid of like sort of very aggressive fascist right-wing fake news sites. Only if we, you know, it doesn't happen, the cycle doesn't happen just by accident. You need to take proper political decisions globally to attack it. And it's not just the West, is it? I mean, again, I've lived through what feels like two Cold Wars now. I remember the fall of the Berlin Wall. David Hasselhoff, maybe you're all too young to remember, he was Knight Rider. You're definitely all too young to remember Knight Rider, but he sang at the fall of the Berlin Wall. And I feel like we're living through another Cold War at the moment with regard to the sort of... I was about to say microaggressions, but that's not the right word. But it's not hot aggression from, well, apart from if you're Ukrainian, from Russia and China, and the sort of rise of totalitarianism within and a power brokerage from those states, a rise of fascism and hard right in the West, whether that's Trump in America, whether that's European right wing. It does feel like we're living through this particular period. I don't think that this is the default any more than I think that the nice everybody investing in inequalities and having better services is the default. They are sort of cyclical and they change. So I don't feel too doom-filled about the next 10 years. I could be wrong. Could be in 10 years' time. Could be scorched earth.
Once again, we are extremely grateful for Jess Phillips taking time of her day to speak to us and answer some burning questions that we had on the future. It's good to see that the ones in charge are hopeful for the future, that we won't be in an apocalyptic wasteland anytime soon. Of course, unless Russia decides to step up their provocation even more. Following on with this interview, we have taken a closer look at how the world is going to be in 2032. What mysteries will the future hold? Will we be at war, or will we continue being where we are now? Whilst Jess Phillips may be right or wrong about the scorched earth debacle, we want to see how the world around us is changing, for the better and the worse. The world in 2032.
It's a bit different from Blade Runner and Back to the Future and Total Recall, though. Hollywood has always been interested in the future, depicting it as a barren wasteland with flying cars and no morals. Luckily, we haven't reached that far into the future just yet. In context, a world in 2032 does not seem too far away. Only a decade. Despite this, with how fast technology is changing year on year, along with the rising poverty crisis, will we end up with a dystopian future that we've all seen hundreds of times before? The aftermath of COVID is one of the main issues that will have to be tackled in the next 10 years whilst countries adapt to the new world and rebuild after economic downfalls. Governments scramble to handle these larger products individually and cooperatively in order to return the world to a peaceful, stable shape. It's argued that one part of the world is being forgotten about, and that is the individual. Research by Dr. Chatterjee and the Department of Psychiatry, the Armed Forces Medical College in Pune, India, has highlighted one of the most impactful effects of the aftermath of COVID, which is the impact of the psychological well-being of those most exposed, such as university students, young children, healthcare workers, and industrial workers. Their research reveals that these groups exhibit higher levels of anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, or depression due to the environment that they work or live in, along with the tribulations of being in a global pandemic and often being forgotten about by their elites or not seeing their family. In this part of the documentary, we'll be focusing on the group that we believe who are most affected, the workers. We're going to see how their life has changed and how the job market will change in the next decade as well. Working during the pandemic has been a grueling task. Often not having adequate PPE or feeling unsafe at work due to no one not really having a clue in the event like the one we found ourselves in. Workers felt ignored and taken advantage of, with nowhere to turn but to carry on with their career. Whilst financial losses can be recovered over time and number 10 can have parties, the health impact of this pandemic is likely going to be longer lasting. One recent event that appeared in the media was the controversy against ATA Industrial in Johor, Malaysia. ATA Industrial were under contract to Dyson, with the workers being building hoovers, hair dryers and hand dryers. If it wasn't for the pandemic though, then the workers would probably continue to work under harsh conditions. Many lived in unsanitary and overcrowded living conditions of up to 80 people per room, and their movements were restricted by security guards, with many of them working up to 18 hours per day. If they turned down the overtime given to them, they weren't allowed to work any overtime at all in the future, which meant they were possibly not able to afford the living costs. They're also forced to work up to 18 months without a single day off. And their work visas were not taken care of at ATA, even though they said they were, thus working and living in the country illegally. ATA Industrial were not the only place that had poor work conditions throughout the pandemic, with other businesses such as Pretty Little Thing, or PLT for short, paying their garment workers in England a despicable £3.50 per hour, as well as working in cramped, unsanitary conditions. PLT, during their Black Friday sales, were selling their clothes for free. For free, not a single penny. The only money you had to spend was for shipping and delivery. But clothing costs money. The money for the garments, the money for the cloth, and the money for the labour. They're clearly taking advantage of the workers and weren't trying hard enough to hide it, because they were paying their workers less than half the minimum wage and giving away clothes for free. Amazon also came under fire during the pandemic for its treatment of its workers within their fulfillment centres. We all used Amazon, most likely during the pandemic, yet we don't understand the detrimental effects that it had. Rosie, an Amazon worker in Staten Island, New York, told Vox Media that at the beginning of the pandemic, more than 50 workers were infected with COVID before Amazon implemented a safer workplace for them with adequate PPE and social distancing. This didn't help much though. With the same fulfillment centre, it's reported that air filters were not being cleaned, colleagues were thrown up in toilets, some had to admit themselves to hospital, and one even died because of the appalling working conditions. Rosie went on to say, "It's like I'm risking my life for a dollar. It's twisted." Workers' well-being has been glossed over throughout the entire pandemic, but it is not all doom and gloom. That's due to the joint experiences of workers being mistreated and taken advantage of. There have been calls to enhance the workplace to make sure that both the workers' physical and mental well-being is looked after. COVID has highlighted the elevated importance of making the workplace a safe and secure space. This has had a knock-on effect, with now more and more work being moved online. It may not continue to be as strong as it was at the peak of the pandemic when everyone didn't know what to do, but remote work and virtual meetings will continue for white-collar workers. Furthermore, the blue-collar workers will gain benefits to ensure countless lives won't be lost or damaged again in future pandemics. In 10 years' time, we will hopefully see enhanced job security for these workers, with businesses ensuring minimum wage to employees while at home or working from home. Factories will no longer be the harsh environments that they are at the moment. Whilst the financial losses will be recovered quickly, the greater gain is that now workers are generally being listened to in their time of need. So, the future for warehouse workers is bright. There is no denying that the fashion industry has become a factor in climate change, with the price of fast fashion being low for the consumer and simultaneously extortionate for the climate and their workers. The rise of sustainable brands in clothing and food across the entire world in all industries has been massive, with Deloitte asking UK consumers how they've changed their habits. 45% of the British population have bought more locally produced goods throughout the pandemic compared to before, with a third, 30%, choosing brands that have ethical practices and values. But buying from these ethical local brands, the large ones will have to follow in line if they want their businesses to continue being at the top. This ensures that workers will in turn enjoy a better quality of life as the consumer cares more for them and their products and thus more conscientious about where they put their money. Over time, the rise of local businesses and more sustainable practices will mean that the workers who work in the factories, farms or any labour-intensive job could lead to a more secure workforce, where the businesses will have to account for their workers. Workers are not expendable, and the pandemic has demonstrated this. Thus, the way both the workers and the consumers are perceived will continue to change as well. COVID-19 has assisted the workers further, with a global survey created by McKinsey & Partners seeing that out of 800 senior executives, two-thirds said they are stepping up their investment in automation and AI either somewhat or significantly. Many companies will begin using automation and AI in warehouses, grocery stores, call centres and manufacturing plants to reduce workplace density and to cope with the surges in demand due to many more people working from home and thus having more free time at hands. One example of this is Starship Technologies. Starship Technologies have used small vehicles in towns like Milton Keynes to deliver food without the need for face-to-face interaction, allowing the delivery drivers who may be overworked and at risk testing positive with COVID to be shifted to warehouses and fulfillment centres to load up the robots instead. AI and automation obviously has been a subject to controversy, as many people are scared and believe these advances in technology will phase out the traditional worker. Over time, however, we can see that workers are now moving to different jobs without the risk of being in high-density workspaces. A spokesperson for Starship has said, "We are doing everything we can to keep our customers and employees safe. All the sanitization processes around our service has been reviewed by experts, and we are following their guidance and operating procedures to ensure a safe and convenient service for everyone. Without robots, more humans are needed in the supply chain, and as humans are the key source of transmission, using robots decreases the risk." One further way that the workplace will become a better environment in the next 10 years is the introduction of the 4-day work week. Now, exciting, I know, but this doesn't mean skipping a day off work and slacking for the other 4 days, but doing 5 days work in 4 days. Microsoft Japan introduced a 4-day, 8-hour work week, and statistics show that productivity increased by 40% and the satisfaction rate increased to 94%. Professor Robert Gross disproves the false claims that a shorter work week would damage the company and the workers' productivity, but actually could be highly beneficial for both the workers and organisations collectively. Countries like Iceland and France are cultivating 4-day, 8-hour work weeks, with these countries having similar GDP per capita to countries like South Korea, Hong Kong and Japan. Other countries like the UK are trialling in certain regions as well. The level of productivity along with the GDP per capita shows that the higher number of hours worked does not increase productivity. This might be due to the mental well-being of the workers along with the psychological pressure of having such long hours decreasing. The workplace is becoming a safe environment, and in 2032, the technological advances will be even greater, meaning the workers won't have to be in crowded, unsanitary environments, but rather work remotely or in smaller density warehouses that can possibly help AI. Along with a shorter work week with increased productivity, workers around the world do have a positive outlook for the next decade.
That was Dom East on the global COVID recovery and its effects on the workplace, an issue that's sure to be a matter of political discourse in 2032. But there's one thing that everyone is talking about in regard to the future, and that's climate change.
In this small part about climate change throughout the 2030s, I'll be answering two key questions. What climate change will entail throughout the 2030s, and whether the world will be on the trajectory towards limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. And whilst I'm sure that many of us are aware of many of the long-term impacts of the ever-changing climate, be that the melting ice caps or concerns about global food security, we must remember that the climate is already changing. We will carry on seeing an increase in the volatility of weather across the world, such as the rising intensity of hurricanes. The northeastern Americas are particularly susceptible to intense storms, with Hurricane Dorian hitting the east coast of North America, with the Bahamas being hit the hardest, crippling the local economy and requiring millions of dollars to regenerate. And who could forget Hurricane Katrina, which led to a humanitarian crisis in the city of New Orleans, which the US system of federal government was unable to react to fast enough. Hurricanes use warm water as their fuel, and with the oceans heating up, these storms will become slower and stronger. The falling speeds of the hurricanes give it more time to destroy local communities, and the rising intensity, for obvious reasons, will make the effects of the hurricanes more severe into the 2030s. Over the past few years, we have also seen hugely damaging wildfires across Australia, Southern Europe, and again the Americas. Most recently, the colossal wildfire in Greece, which turned large parts of the beautiful island of Evia into a barren wasteland, again, crippling the local economy and communities. With the rising atmospheric temperatures making the onset of wildfires more likely, and the stronger winds due to volatile weather patterns causing these fires to spread more rapidly, these wildfires will only become more intense throughout the 2030s and further into the future. The continuing melting ice caps in the North Pole, Antarctica, and Greenland will remain a huge problem throughout the 2030s. Greenland has already been pointed to as having reached an irreversible tipping point, where the winter season only acts as a pause button following the rapid melting throughout the summer period. Rising sea levels will submerge some small island states such as the Maldives if they are not dealt with properly, and while scientists are not predicting that these events will occur throughout the 2030s, sea level communities have experienced, and will continue to experience, unprecedented levels of flooding throughout the 2030s. In 2032 and throughout the later 2030s, these weather events will only become more frequent in occurrence and more intense in nature. We have so far painted a very stark picture on what humanity will have to face throughout the 2030s, but it must be said that these impacts are not unknown to world leaders, and there have been numerous international summits held across the world where the sole purpose has been how to mitigate the reality of climate change. Recent global summits, most significantly the 2015 Paris summit and the recent COP26 summit, have yielded some promising results, and it's clear that new international norms around the climate are beginning to cement themselves. We now hear a continuous rhetoric from world leaders that we have collectively overconsumed the world's resources, and that we collectively need to resolve this in order to, yes, save the planet, but more significantly, to save humanity as we know it. Well, they've got all the talk, but are they walking the walk? Let's have a look at what these states are actually doing to implement climate regime and to place us on the trajectory of limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels. A number of countries have made ambitious long-term climate commitments. For example, the UK, France, and Spain have committed to being net zero by 2050, along with the US, although that target isn't legally binding. Germany and Sweden have gone further and committed to net zero by 2045, China by 2060, and India by 2070. But a number of these countries' 2013 targets simply don't align with their net zero goals. Take the examples of Australia, Russia, China, and Brazil. There is a distinct credibility gap between their 2030 and carbon neutral targets. In other words, if these countries go into the 2030s at their current emissions targets and don't find a way to accelerate decarbonisation, they are very unlikely to hit their net zero targets in the timeframe that they hope to. In a report done by the UN, which aggregated all of the 2030 emissions targets agreed so far, they found that the world would eventually reach the level of 2.7 degrees Celsius warmer than pre-industrial levels, 0.7 degrees above what scientists believe to be the threshold, before serious, irreversible damage is done to the climate. At the moment, Europe seems to be taking the lead on international climate regime, and after delving deeper into the outcomes of the recent COP26 talks, it would seem naive to think that certain states will hoist themselves onto the same trajectory as Europe in terms of becoming carbon neutral as we move into the 2030s. At COP26, an original plan to completely phase out coal was weakened to an overall pledge to phase down coal after late interventions from China and India. Whilst Russia made pledges on deforestation, there was a clear intention to continue their oil industry, which, let's be completely clear, the Western world will continue to purchase and utilise. At COP26, Australia failed to strengthen their 2030 emissions targets, already amongst the lowest in the world, partly due to their economy being reliant on the coal industry. And what is perhaps the most concerning is that the leaders of two of the highest emitting countries, President Xi of China and President Putin of Russia, didn't even turn up to the conference, instead sending ministers and diplomats on their behalf. Maybe they aren't interested. Maybe they were just being provocative. The examples that I've given illustrate that the world still isn't on the same page regarding the urgency required to reverse the damage humanity has made to the planet. And why would these countries have changed their attitudes by 2032? Current international politics suggests that President Xi and Putin will remain in office indefinitely, and it's clear that they do not want international climate regime to hinder their economic growth. But we must ask ourselves, should all countries be on the same page? The leaders of developing nations went to COP26 with a stark message to the leaders of rich nations, that due to their historical consumption of fossil fuels, there must be a package of funds provided by rich nations to developing nations in order to help them fund decarbonisation efforts. The sentiment behind this is the principle that developing nations should have the space to grow their economies during the new age of decarbonisation. After all, why should developing countries curb their emissions, which would be detrimental to their economies, when the US and Europe have historically been able to freely utilise the Earth's natural resources and have grown huge economies out of it? Developing countries across the world at COP26 were united in pointing out to rich countries that they have repeatedly failed to reach their commitments in mobilising funds for decarbonisation. We have a moral duty to facilitate economic growth in these nations, as Western countries have been able to grow so rapidly from these fossil fuels. But consider this. Even if all countries are supposedly on the same page by 2032 and set ambitious emissions targets, how will we know that these countries will actually stick to their commitments? Yes, some emission commitments may be legally binding. However, there are currently no international enforcement arrangements which guarantee full compliance from all states. Collective action theory asserts that when states have an economic incentive to emit, they may free ride on the efforts of other states, subsequently undercutting them economically, as well as reaping the benefits of climate regime undertaken by compliant states. Imperfect information is an enemy to climate regime. The fact that states don't know for sure what the intentions of other states are makes the risk of snowballing incompliance a real threat to global security. Stringent and effective enforcement arrangements can help turn the tide in favour of humanity against the ever-changing climate and help us reach the favoured trajectory of limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels. If these issues aren't solved, or at least getting solved by the time we get to 2032, the prospect of keeping the 1.5 degree dream alive seems close to impossible. But I will finish by saying that despite the pessimistic view of the world in 2032 that I've painted, it really is not all doom and gloom. Humans are a creative, innovative, and intelligent species who have so far been able to take on the challenges that the Earth has presented to us, and it is quite incredible what humans have been able to achieve through breakthroughs in science and technology. The business world has the means, and increasingly the incentives, to innovate and create sustainable forms of green energy which may at some point compete with fossil fuels on a purely economic basis. As long as the public and private sector work together effectively, and as long as there are great minds in our society, which there always will be, the dream of a green industrial revolution will always be possible. We may be a long way off successful international climate regime, but we are growing up in an age where these environmental issues are ever more prevalent, and you can't spend a day in a number of societies where you aren't reminded of the damage we have done to planet Earth. And no matter which way you look at it, it is clear that we have begun to forge a path towards a future in which both humanity and nature can live in harmony. Up next, we have Sahila Asir, who's going to be shedding some light on the future cost of living crisis and poverty, another issue that will affect the people of 2032.
Currently, in 2022, the standard and cost of living is rising at rates that are not equal to average household incomes. After 2 years of uncertainty amid the ongoing coronavirus pandemic, the public are now faced with further issues. The Resolution Foundation, an independent economic think tank, stated 2022 will be the year of the squeeze. This highlights the extent to which households will be affected. When considering the world in 2032, the standard of living and quality of life are elements to explore. But what is the reason living costs are increasing? The cost of living crisis in the UK is currently due to numerous aspects, resulting in households being left with much less disposable income. One of the impacts is rising inflation. This time last year, the Bank of England was forecasting that inflation would be at 2%, which is its target level. Instead, the Consumer Price Index is already at the highest level since the early 1990s, sitting at 5.4%. Inflation is the rate at which prices across the economy are changing each year and refers to a general progressive increase in prices of goods and services. Therefore, as inflation has rapidly increased in the past year, the public's purchasing has appreciated as incomes have not become relative with inflation. If this trend continues, people will struggle to make ends meet, as prices of goods and services which are necessities will continue to rise and not reflect their wages. Another cause of living costs increasing in the UK is the rise of energy prices. The UK energy regulator Ofgem announced that the price cap would increase from its current equivalent annual cost by 54%. This is a steep rise in household bills, and without financial aid, some 2 million more people are forecasted to be plunged into fuel poverty this year, meaning 6 million people in total would be struggling to heat and power their homes. Many families are in situations that they must choose between vital essentials such as food and heat, as they can no longer afford both. A developed country like the UK, with one of the world's largest economies, has a significant amount of its population struggling to afford necessities. This current circumstance is extremely worrying, and one can only assume if it's not dealt with soon, by 2032, things will only get worse. We have most recently seen the withdrawal of the £20 universal credit uplift, greatly impacting the financial situation of low-income households. Though it was a temporary measure during the pandemic, it greatly assisted those eligible. Many households will be driven into poverty simply due to the lack of intervention and financial support, as living costs are rising rapidly. The shortages seen in supermarkets and petrol stations recently were due to the national lack of HGV lorry drivers. The UK's manufacturing and retail industries are totally dependent on the movement of goods via road, so this had a significant effect. This crisis had a large impact on consumers as household goods became scarce due to them not being available in supermarkets. The fuel crisis had taken place even though petrol was available, however there was a lack of drivers to deliver fuel to the station. For a developed country to lack in the supply of basic goods and services is worrying behaviour. Additionally, the UK population is expected to grow by 8 million by 2032. The effects of shortages are being seen across the country with the current population. Will the UK be able to manage with this increase without further impacting the standard and cost of living? Currently, the poverty rate among working households is the highest ever in the UK. Many of them with two working parents are turning to the UK's food banks as the cost of living crisis deepens. A Food Standards Agency survey published last month reveals that between April and June last year, 15% of people in England, Wales and Northern Ireland were food insecure. This figure has continued to climb in recent years and is extremely worrying considering that families are unable to make ends meet even though they are employed. This highlights the extent of the cost of living crisis in the UK, as prices are continuing to increase, affecting the ability of households to afford necessities. The reliance on food banks has continued to increase since 2010, therefore for the past 12 years the government has not been able to successfully intervene as more are falling into poverty. We can only assume that by 2032, the situation will be much more worse due to the further increase of prices seen recently. Whilst the public are struggling due to the increase of prices, wages are also not rising with inflation. However, interest and tax rates continue to increase, which further impacts households' incomes. This also includes an increase in national insurance contributions from April 2022. The public will face a further proportion of the income being deducted whilst they are struggling due to rising costs. wages not increasing in proportion with inflation and tax rates will have an incredibly negative effect, as people will continuously be expected to budget and struggle rather than receiving reasonable income. What is also worrying is that when pay does increase, as seen recently, pay rises fall behind inflation. The Office for National Statistics said although average total earnings grew an annual rate of 3.5% in November, the impact from soaring rates of inflation meant workers suffered a cut in their pay. Taxes are increasing while wages are falling. These aspects are further contributing to the cost of living crisis. The population is being affected in multiple directions. They are earning less, paying more taxes, and also struggling to afford goods and services due to price increases. The direction the government is continuing in implies that by 2032, the cost of living crisis will deepen without any intervention. Confidence for the next decade is very limited as the economic situation continues to worsen. Currently in the UK, one in three adults is affected by the housing emergency. The main cause of the UK housing crisis is that there has been a decline in the number of social homes being built while the population and needs increases. This has led to a large amount of people being subject to unaffordable homes with private renting. The UK does not have enough social housing, as in recent years more homes are being demolished than built. Over time, the government has begun to support the public less. The figure of those affected by this housing crisis will only increase without more social homes being built. If the cost of living continues to rise over the next 10 years, by 2032 the general population will not be financially comfortable, as according to a YouGov poll, 42% of Britons are expecting their household's financial situation to get worse within the next year. We can assume that this trend will continue if there is no intervention from the government. As price levels are continuing to soar whilst taxes are increasing, the public's earnings are significantly affected. This taking place whilst there are cuts to universal credit is deepening the cost of living crisis as it greatly impacts income. Also taking into consideration the housing crisis, the standard of living in the UK is in great danger at the moment. We must sadly assume that by 2032 the situation will be much worse, as all of these aspects have not improved in recent years. The world in 2032 seems to have an uncertain outlook. We have looked at the effects of coronavirus, climate change and living costs. The pandemic greatly affected many lives but has also inspired changes. The aftermath of COVID has led to major improvements in technology and there are hopes of further improved productivity for the next decade. However, the prospects for climate change require there to be action taken across the globe to limit global warming, and the possibility of this taking place is not well assured. And finally, without government action, the standard of living in the UK will continue to fall as the cost of living crisis is ongoing.
Reading University has been a centre point for bands, with U2 playing the concert here in 1980, up to modern day with rock and band societies being some of the largest societies on campus. Yet, it does seem quite daunting for a new band to find their feet due to the current state of the world, coming out of a pandemic whilst struggling with the hassles of Brexit touring. We had the chance to sit down with one of the members of an up-and-coming London-based band, Jacquard Looms, who have recently hit 1 million streams on Spotify for their song Moth. I first started by asking Joey, the band member who joined us on the call, how long they've been creating music for.
We've been making music like our whole lives, but under our current outfit, Jacquard Looms, we started releasing music in January 2020, so just before lockdown.
Yeah. And before anything, I want to say congratulations on your 1 million streams on your song Moth.
Thank
you. Massive milestone. Well done to you and the boys.
Thanks a lot. Thank you so much.
Yeah, no worries. So obviously being a new young British band, you've had to overcome many challenges that other British bands may not have had to overcome. One of them being Brexit. So how does it? Do you think that Brexit has changed the music industry within the UK?
The main thing about Brexit, I think, is touring. And it basically means that you've got to spend more money if you want to go touring. Which is shit, but so that's definitely the biggest downfall of on the music industry from as a result of Brexit. It's just that you've got so many more visas to pay for, more paperwork in general, and generally speaking, things take a lot more time.
Yeah.
Luckily for me and many musicians alike, it doesn't really affect you because your manager or something will take care of that, but it does affect you in the sense that you'll probably make a little bit less money from touring and stuff because you've got to pay for your visas.
Yeah. So following along with that, another challenge obviously you guys had to overcome since you started January 2020 is COVID. So how did COVID affect the band schedule for such as future dates of touring or recording or things like that as well?
Yeah, COVID's an interesting one because obviously no one could tour, no one could gig, which is a real hardship. So therefore, like, your income drops, obviously. But at the same time, like, it's difficult to say because obviously we all understand that a lot of people had an awful time during the lockdowns, and I really wouldn't wish that sort of pain or hardship on anyone. But we found it just an incredibly productive period. We made so much music on the second and third lockdowns. So one of the other guys in Looms is my brother, and the other one lives locally. So we formed a bubble, and we were able to just literally make music in the studio every single night. So in that sense, like, I didn't really have an issue, but in the other sense, our income obviously stopped because of no touring or gigging. But then at the same time, like, most of our successes came out of lockdown, i.e. Million Streams on Moth. So that was great. But then another interesting flip side to that is that no one's commuting, so therefore streams just generally shut down. So therefore your income from streaming services like Spotify or Apple Music go down. I don't know, it's certainly a mixed bag of advantages and disadvantages. All I can say for sure is I'd be glad to see the back of it, and now we're starting to tour again. It's great.
Yeah, of course, that's completely understandable. Perfect. Final question. Do you have any tips for new musicians who want to get into the scene and might be scared about things such as COVID or Brexit or issues involved in that? You can't do what old musicians used to and just go out and tour. You have to try and find new ways to get onto the scene. Do you have any tips for them at all?
Yeah, I do. I definitely say don't be disheartened by current political affairs. Whilst things that happen, i.e. Brexit and COVID, are shit for creatives, just keep going. Just don't let yourself get too down about it. Like, music and all of the arts are something that humans will never lose. And therefore, it will always prevail. And therefore, your main concern at all times should be about the art you're creating, whether it's film or music or whatever. Don't worry about don't get too bogged down with the politic, because it will sort itself out. And I'd also say, remember that whenever there are these like political hardships that come along in life, there always seem to be creative outbursts afterwards. Maybe go along the train of thought of everything happens for a reason and everything will work out in the end. And perhaps that's naive, but it seems to work for me, and that would be my advice. Just don't worry too much, it will be okay.
Perfect.
Keep your head up.
Perfect. Thank you so much for taking time out once again.
So you heard it. Coronavirus and Brexit hasn't stopped this band progressing to where they are now. Now with venues being open and more live music coming back into towns like Reading, make sure to get out and support bands at venues to get them back to how they were before. And as said by Joey, if you want to go and create music, arts or anything else for that matter, then just do it.
So there you have it. The world in 2032. After listening to this instalment of The Politics Show, you may be feeling sceptical and pessimistic about the state of the world in 2032. But remember this. As I pointed out in my piece about the climate, and as Dom and Sahila have reiterated, it's not all doom and gloom. We believe in human ingenuity and resilience, and we recognise the huge challenges that humanity has faced up to during our tenure on planet Earth. Whether it's world wars, pandemics, imperialism or rogue leaders, humanity has been able to find a way through, and we on The Politics Show have full confidence that the 2030s will be an age of success and prosperity in the world.
Thank you for joining us. It's been a pleasure.
We hope that you join us again for The Politics Show on B Radio next week.
Goodbye from Archie.
Goodbye from Sahela.
And goodbye from me, Dom.